Welcome back. This is Kelly Gregg, G-R-E-G-G, of kellygregg.com, and this is number 16 podcast in the series Health Topics. I have an ebook on the subject, really an ebook article, and this is the podcast that goes along with the ebook. I'm going to be talking about what is gluten, mainly from a biochemistry point of view, and I'm also going to talk about both gluten sensitivity and bread sensitivity. By now, everyone has heard of gluten. More specifically, everyone has heard of gluten-free. This means that whatever gluten is, this product does not have any. Before we start talking about gluten-free, let's see what gluten is. This is a somewhat technical chapter, and I don't blame you if you skip it. It is here mainly for reference. It has almost nothing to do with the maintenance diet, unless some of the food engineer's clients have a gluten problem. As we spoke about earlier, the properties of gluten allow us to have bread that is not as dense and has a more palpable grain texture. It turns out that wheat contains lots of gluten, which is simply a group of proteins that have an elastic property so that it may contain any carbon dioxide produced by the yeast and hence cause the bread to rise upon warming of the yeast. The more rising, the less dense the product. You can make flour out of all kinds of grains and legumes, but only wheat, rye, and barley contain enough gluten to enable the bread to rise. I will talk about oats later. Leavened bread usually means that yeast is present. You can also have chemical leavening, that is baking powder, that can cause a slight rise. You can have all the yeast you want, but if you don't have gluten, you get flat bread. Nowadays, we can buy gluten-free risen bread, which means we don't use grains with gluten, and that we add something else, like xanthan gum, which is a product of the bacteria Xanthomonas campestis, grown in a sugar solution, or you could add guar gum, made from the guar bean plant, to enable a rise. These replicate the elastic properties of gluten, but give the bread a slightly different taste. Almost all the bread eaten in the United States is from wheat and thus contains gluten. I am going to go into a little biochemistry in which the nomenclature is quite confusing. It's almost like this was done intentionally. Anyone with common sense can follow the steps. It is just that now we have to learn a little foreign language. This seems to be true of almost all science. It sounds hard because we just don't know the language. Anyway, my job is to teach you. The gluten proteins are composed of two different kinds of proteins. You have the prolamins, which are plant storage proteins having a high proline acid content, and you have the glutalins. These also form the network that holds starch granules in the endosperm. The prolamins are different in wheat, rye, barley, and oats. In wheat, this group of proteins is called gliadins. In barley, it's horadinins. In rye, it's cicalins. And in oats, it's avenins. All of these are groups of proteins. Remember, I told you that wheat dough is composed of wheat grain with three sets of chromosomes. Each set may code for slightly different proteins, so that with each variety of wheat grain, the composition of the proteins may vary slightly. I am just going to talk about wheat gluten. This group of prolamins proteins in wheat is called gliadins. Let me replace prolamins with gliadins since I am only talking about wheat. Okay, so now we have gluten is composed of gliadins. Remember, the group of prolamins in wheat. If this were barley or rye, it would be horadiens or cicalin. And glutalins. To review,
I said gluten is composed of prolamins and glutalins, but since we're using a specific protolin called gliadins, now I'm going to say gluten is composed of gliadins and glutalins. You can see how having this in written form is very helpful. Pay attention to the ends of these words, as they are all going to sound alike. Sometimes I wonder if this was done intentionally to make it harder to understand. Sometimes they call a whole group of prolamin proteins gluten proteins, regardless of which grain the prolamin came from. Just like the prolamin proteins in wheat are called gliadins, the glutalin proteins in wheat are called glutenins. Barley and rye glutenins are just called barley glutenin and rye glutenin. So now we have gluten in wheat is composed of gliadins and glutenins. If this were, say, rye bread, it would be gliadins and barley glutenin. In wheat, gluten is formed when the glutenin protein molecules cross-link to form a network attached to the gliadin molecules. This increases the elasticity and thickness of the dough, allowing the yeast carbon dioxide to be trapped in the dough and make it less dense. Throughout history and to this present day, people like their bread to be light and less dense. Most of the bread that is sold is not dense and heavy, but rather light and airy. Most of the problems that drive the creation of gluten-free bread lie in the gliadin component of gluten. The gliadins can be separated into four groups: alpha, beta, gamma, and omega gliadins. These, in turn, are associated with different types of anti-inflammatory diseases, including celiac disease. I will talk about why gluten-free bread exists in the next chapter, when I talk about celiac disease. Rye, barley, and oats may all be said to contain gluten, but this is not the wheat gluten we are talking about, since the prolamin proteins are different. Nevertheless, we call it gluten and speak of them just as we would wheat gluten. Now is the time to talk about oats. Technically, oats contain gluten, but this is not the same as gluten in wheat, barley, or rye. It does not produce a good enough gluten network that enables bread to rise. Hence, oat bread always has a better gluten source added. When we say gluten-free oat flour, what we mean is that this flour does not contain any components, or very little, of gluten from wheat, barley, or rye. Oats are hulled, and this must be removed before eating. The dehulled grain is called oat groats. This is the whole grain. You can soak this in water, cook them, and eat them as they are. Needless to say, these have large particle sizes. You can steam the groats and press them between rollers to get rolled oats. The advantage of doing this is that they can cook faster and they have a different texture. You can also get steel-cut oats, in which you just chop these groats into little pieces. These have a little longer cook time than rolled and a slightly different texture. Instant oats are the most processed, as they are pre-cooked, dried, rolled, and pressed thinner than rolled oats. These cook even faster and are soft and mushy. Unlike flour, all of these have a large particle size. Oats are a grain and are just as good for you as wheat bread. Their disadvantage is that they are not as portable. You could cook up a loaf of bread 4,000 years ago, put it in a sack, and use that for food the next few days if you were traveling. A bag of oats was not quite as portable, and you would have to cook them as needed, although you could just chew the groats. This takes a long time. Like the wheat with hulls, the oats could be stored a long time and used to prevent starvation. Oats like cool, wet summers, so were popular in Ireland and the Scandinavian countries. Since historical records are from the Middle East and oats did not grow as well there, they did not catch on, so that there is not as much historical information as wheat. Regardless, the usage of bread is just too handy, and it was the most widely used grain. Okay, I know I am disregarding China, who did have a large empire and was based more on rice than wheat, but I don't speak Chinese. Oats are not really gluten-free. It does have some gluten, although with some different proteins than wheat, and some with gluten sensitivity can tolerate them without reactions. This is always going to be a trial-by-fire approach. If you have real severe celiac disease, do not try it. If you think you have a little gluten sensitivity, you may be able to tolerate oats, and they are a great addition to a nutritious diet. At the end, I will wrap up how we have corrupted wheat bread from its beginning and how the processing of flour has contributed to the obesity epidemic. I can't say the same thing about oats. The processing does not lead to small particle sizes, and the use of oat flour is minuscule compared to wheat flour. There are almost no chemical additives. Unfortunately, oats are rather bland and do not provide the flavor of wheat bread. Oats are underutilized in the modern diet. Oats are rich in soluble fiber, which I will discuss toward the end. Back to gluten. Wheat, rye, and barley are the only plants that contain gluten such that the bread can be made from the flour. That flour can contain air and hence be classified as risen bread. The gluten proteins enable the dough to trap gas that can give the final product a crumb structure that is not dense, as well contribute to the overall formation of taste. The ability of grain to be stored for long periods has prevented starvation throughout history. The ability of gluten has enabled flour to be fermented by the yeast and cooked, making the protein and carbohydrate readily available and digestible, all due to gluten. Gluten is not a single protein, but a group of proteins. There are many varieties of bread, which means there are many different genes in bread. This means that the proteins making up gluten may not all be the identical in various varieties. Therefore, when I say gluten, it is not a singular protein, but rather a family of proteins that altogether can create a protein network that is both elastic and plastic, and therefore permit the bread to rise. Rye and barley do not form as strong a gluten network as wheat. Gluten is described as both elastic, meaning if stretched, it will try to return to its original shape, and plastic, meaning it will deform under pressure without tearing. The dough can now expand under the pressure of carbon dioxide produced by the yeast, yet stretched so that the gas cannot escape. If the dough were just elastic, the gas would just accumulate in a few large pockets. If it were just plastic, the gas would escape through the dough. There needs to be a balance of these properties to give us a light, fluffy bread. The water-soluble albumin and globulin proteins account for about 20% of the protein in flour. The insoluble gluten proteins, gliadins and glutenins, account for the rest. The gluten proteins are quite large, from a few thousand amino acids up to a million. If you add a few million water molecules, the interaction becomes quite complicated and is not completely understood. These proteins are long chains, sometimes coil, and may have different side chains. They may be folded on back to itself, or intertwined with itself, or with other proteins, and can be chemically bonded to other proteins even then. Gluten proteins do not dissolve in water, but water molecules can fill spaces between the tangles of protein. When water is mixed with flour, the proteins begin to untangle as the water molecules separate the gluten molecules, by forming hydrogen bonds. The kneading of bread, which is necessary to form an organized gluten network, aligns these molecules as they are unfolded, and thus facilitates cross-linkings between the protein chains, which stiffens the dough. There is still some coiling of the molecules, and this contributes to the elasticity of the dough. As you straighten out the molecules through kneading, the coil topography tends to pull them back together. Fat in the flour and salt molecules affect the cross-linking in multiple ways that can either strengthen the cross-linking bonds or weaken them. The bonds between gluten molecules often involve sulfur atoms, and these bonds can be broken or even encouraged with the physical manipulation of the environment, that is, kneading. It is even possible to break down the gluten network by over-kneading, although this is unlikely unless you are using machinery. You now know more about gluten than most people. For most people, you don't need to know any of these details, just that you need gluten in the flour to make risen bread. Still, this book does serve as a reference book as well as a textbook, so I had to include the chapter. At least you can recognize the role of gluten in the history of bread. I must now remind you to go buy my book. My wife is getting tired of me spending all this time making these podcasts and actually writing these books. Unless I make more money at it, she is going to insist that I get another part-time job. I already have one part-time job, and there are only so many hours in the day. This chapter talks about wheat disease, especially celiac disease. From my point of view, celiac is an example of a dietary disease that involves both your genes, probable epigenetic changes, the gut biome, autoimmune disease, and the spaces between the intestinal cells, also sometimes called the interstitial space. It has become apparent that certain conditions and symptoms may be relieved by eliminating gluten in the diet. For the most part, these conditions involve some type of activation of the immune system, which can inflict both direct damages to the villi lining the gut, as well as causing various systemic effects. There also appears to be a category of symptomatic disorders, whereby gut symptoms appear to resolve with the elimination of gluten in the diet, despite not being able to prove an immune system connection. The serious diseases, such as celiac disease, gluten ataxia, and dermatitis herpetiformis, may require several diagnostic tests, including a biopsy, to determine the correct diagnosis. These are autoimmune diseases and are nothing to screw around with. It is important to treat them vigorously. Fortunately, these are a small percentage of those presenting with possible gluten sensitivity. There is also a classification of gluten sensitivity known as wheat allergy. This can be considered more like a food allergy or hay fever. There are many proteins in wheat to which allergy can develop. Like other allergies, sometimes it is difficult to track down the specific protein. This is an immunoglobulin E-related immune response, unlike celiac disease. Finally, we have non-celiac gluten or wheat sensitivity, which is a separate category and a spectrum of symptoms that seem to be relieved by a reduction of wheat in the diet. A diagnosis of celiac disease and wheat allergy must be eliminated to get this diagnosis. A common denominator of all these conditions is that removal of gluten or wheat in the diet improves the symptoms. Some of these may involve wheat germ agglutination. Let's look at each of these categories. Celiac disease is a chronic autoimmune disease that causes intestinal villi destruction. The manifestations of this disease revolve around the malabsorption of nutrients caused by this destruction. Historically, this was identified in children in whom the failure to thrive and gain weight was more easily manifested. The consequences of this malabsorption also included diarrhea, abdominal distension and discomfort, and abnormal stools. These symptoms resulted from the bacterial fermentation and digestion of unabsorbed nutrients. This also leads to deficiencies in various vitamins and minerals, with resulting health consequences. These symptoms are subtle, and often several years pass before the correct diagnosis is made. In adults, this may only be manifested by fatigue or anemia, with no or vague intestinal complaints, and often may be confused with irritable bowel syndrome. To review, wheat gluten is gliadins and glutenins. The gliadins can further be broken into alpha and beta gliadins, gamma gliadins, and omega gliadins. These are elements to which the immune system reacts and results in subsequent destruction of villi and malabsorption. As a result of the chronic inflammation induced, other immunological diseases become manifest. One of the results of this inflammation is that larger proteins may be absorbed instead of digested into amino acids. These proteins may further activate the immune system against proteins that may be similar to your normal tissue and result in various immune complexes diseases. Celiac disease was recognized for hundreds of years and often called SPRU, a malnutrition syndrome. The connection with gluten was not well recognized till studies after the Dutch famine in 1944 to 1945 showed that children hospitalized for malabsorption syndrome improved as wheat was not available. In the ensuing years, gluten was identified as the cause, and a gluten-free diet was found to be the only effective treatment for this condition. As an aside, this famine also gave us clues to epigenetic changes in individuals. Those who were pregnant during this famine eventually had their children studied and grandchildren, and epigenetic changes could be demonstrated. I'll go over epigenetic diseases in the next book I write. Celiac disease is a genetic disease. A gene is inherited, which makes receptors on immune cells that determine if a substance is foreign to the body more sensitive to gluten proteins. This revs up the immune system to begin an immune response to the villi in the intestine. Stopping exposure to these proteins diminishes the immune response over time. Most all celiac patients improve markedly after stopping the ingestion of gluten. Like everything else in the human body, people are slightly different, and some require absolutely no gluten to get better, others just a marked decrease in intake. The diagnosis is not particularly easy. There is a test that, if it is negative, means you probably do not have this disease. We can test for anti-transglutaminase antibodies, which is positive in the majority of celiac patients. The disease has a spectrum of severity, which makes it difficult to absolutely make the diagnosis based on one test. Even a biopsy of intestinal villi can be ambiguous. The importance of making the diagnosis is that the treatment must be adhered to throughout one's life. Celiac does not get better on its own, and gluten avoidance must be vigorously enforced. Another disease, dermatitis herpetiformis, is also a chronic autoimmune disease characterized by blistering skin conditions that can be intensely itchy. It is a cutaneous manifestation of celiac disease involving the same type of genes. Anti-transglutaminase antibodies now affect the skin instead of the villi. Various medications can provide some symptomatic improvement, but like celiac, a gluten-free diet is the mainstay of treatment. These individuals will have concomitant villi injury. Biopsy material of the skin is much easier to obtain, and those with this manifestation of the disease have an easier time getting a firm diagnosis of celiac. Less than 1% of people may have some degree of celiac disease. Less than 0.1% have skin manifestations. Gluten ataxia. I include this condition because it is also treated with a gluten-free diet and is presumed to also be an autoimmune disease triggered by the ingestion of gluten. Ataxia is a condition with gait abnormality, incoordination, or tremor, and is a result of the death of neurons in the cerebellum. It is not a celiac disease, and celiac disease does not progress to ataxia. Less than 10% of people with this condition present with any gastrointestinal symptoms, although about 40% can be shown to have some intestinal damage. This appears to arise from a different variant of the gene that produces susceptibility to celiac disease, yet the treatment is the same. I include this rare disease because if the neurons die, they do not grow back, and extreme gluten avoidance needs to start right now. Wheat allergy. This is the second of the three groups of diseases that we treat with the gluten-free diet, although wheat allergy does not have to involve the gluten proteins, but rather one of the other many proteins in wheat. Remember, there are water-soluble globulin and albumin proteins in wheat, as well as gluten proteins. In some with wheat allergy, you may have to avoid all wheat products, not just gluten. Small amounts of rye or barley may not cause any problem. Wheat allergy is not celiac disease. Symptoms of wheat allergy are similar to other food allergies and include eczema, hives, asthma, allergic rhinitis, abdominal cramping, nausea, and vomiting. Unlike celiac, these symptoms arise soon after exposure to wheat or gluten. Gluten is just one of the groups of proteins in wheat. Asthma may be related to wheat allergy and wheat dust and pollen. Wheat allergy may be quite complicated to track down. There are about 30 to 50,000 different wheat varieties, and there are many subtle differences between the proteins present, as each of these varieties have a different genome. Most wheat in the U.S. comes from about 500 to 1,000 different varieties. You may be buying hard red winter wheat, but two adjacent fields may have a different variety. You may be allergic to the wheat in one field, but not the next. Often these proteins may be slightly different, maybe one amino acid, but will cross-react with the immune system. Although the gluten from different varieties may be different, they are close enough that avoiding gluten in general may be enough. I will mention the rare condition of exercise-induced anaphylaxis. Anaphylaxis is a life-threatening allergic response, the kind we use the EpiPen. It is not well understood, but exercise has something to do with it. A subset of this condition is when exercise only invokes this reaction when the ingestion of a food allergen previously took place. Wheat is one of the common trigger foods, and the element responsible may be that omega gliadin in wheat gluten I showed you earlier. Celiacs are sensitive to the alpha, beta, and gamma gliadins. Non-celiac gluten or wheat sensitivity. This is a somewhat nebulous clinical entity in which the ingestion of gluten leads to intestinal or extra-intestinal symptoms that improve once gluten-containing foods have been removed from the diet. For this diagnosis to be made, celiac disease and wheat allergy must have been excluded from the diagnosis. There is no biological marker for this condition, and the diagnosis is based upon the improvement of symptoms once the treatment, which is decreasing gluten in the diet, has been initiated. As you can imagine, there may be a placebo component in this treatment. There are many people with digestive or intestinal disorders. They have bloating or cramping after eating. They may have fatigue that cannot be explained. It may be that headaches, constipation, diarrhea, depression, emotional lability may be present without any other particular diagnosis. I would not be surprised if diet were a contributing factor to many of these difficult-to-diagnose conditions. Our diet today is markedly different from history, and there is no doubt that the incidence of obesity, diabetes, autoimmune disease, and cancer is increasing. Our diet now contains high fructose corn syrup, processed sugar, soybean, various chemicals and preservatives, and very different preparation methods that were used in the majority of human history. I have already said this in one way or another, that I believe the gut microbiome may be responsible for many of these diseases. And the problem with the gut microbiome is their environment, which is basically our diet. Again, I will pursue this further in my next book. Gluten sensitivity can be indistinguishable from irritable bowel syndrome, a condition that includes abdominal pain and changes to bowel movement patterns. There is an association between anxiety, depression, and fatigue. There is much communication between the brain and the gut, and disorders of either may affect the other. I cannot ignore these symptoms, as it appears almost half the patients with gluten sensitivity have some element of these symptoms. It does no good to say it's psychological because, even if it is, what do you do about it? You must address the reasons the patient came in to see you in the first place. First, we must address celiac disease. This is a serious condition, and no matter what other symptoms you have, we must stop gluten ingestion. Failure to do this will lead to serious health problems. Second, let us eliminate food allergy. Often this will occur soon after eating the offending food, and the connection can be made. Finally, examine the patient to try to eliminate a diagnosable condition associated with a treatment or a psychological condition that may require medication. We then may still be left with a large number of people who just don't feel right and whose current condition is affecting their life adversely. Diet therapy is a logical starting point to treat these conditions. Treating obesity and prediabetes may go a long way toward improving health. Addressing this issue may improve the quality of life of these patients. Even if we treat obesity, prediabetes, patients may still experience some of these GI symptoms. Food elimination diets may be attempted and can sometimes be a fruitful approach. In modern times, the elimination of gluten from the diet has become a practical treatment that a patient can adopt with little oversight. In man's history, this may have been more difficult, and in fact could have threatened survival, since grain has traditionally been the food category stored for lean times, and stopping wheat intake may have led to malnutrition. Now, that is not the case, and eliminating gluten is not a detriment to a healthy diet. I will now mention wheat germ agglutination. Lectins are a group of proteins that bind to carbohydrates and are present in plants. These serve as defensive elements against external pathogens such as bacteria, fungi, and insects. The most common lectin we hear about in bread is gluten, and we have seen that this can adversely affect some individuals by interacting with their immune system. Lectins are routinely used in scientific testing to bind various glycoproteins, and we eat lectins every day in our normal diet. Of interest in nutrition is a lectin called wheat germ agglutination, found in cereal wheat germ. Wheat germ agglutination has been accused of having adverse health effects both by binding to cells in the gut and causing damage. and by being absorbed into the body and having direct effects on various cells as well as the immune system. As a result, some have advised us to avoid whole wheat bread, as normal flour bread has had the bran and germ removed, thus lowering the amount of wheat germ agglutinin exposure. Wheat germ agglutinin may be able to replicate some of the actions of insulin, such as encouraging fat cells to absorb glucose and turn it into fat, thus promoting obesity. Various effects of wheat germ agglutinin on cells can be demonstrated in cells in the laboratory. Let us look a little more closely. In a recent thesis, CUSMA 2009, consumption of 50 grams of wheat germ, the equivalent of eating 80 slices of whole wheat bread, was given to normal people. Blood samples were taken regularly up to 24 hours later, and no wheat germ agglutinin was detected. It may be that the level was lower than the sensitivity of the test, but certainly a large amount was not absorbed. It can also be shown that heat treatment, that is cooking, greatly affects the biological activity of dietary lectin wheat germ agglutinin. We already process grains with yeast and bacteria to enhance the absorption of nutrients, and these processes may diminish the wheat germ agglutinin burden. We can show in animals that a high wheat germ agglutinin intake can adversely affect the gut microbiome and affect inflammatory markers in white blood cells. Some believe that dietary lectin uptake can affect weight gain by causing leptin resistance, a hormone that signals the brain to stop eating and hence could trigger overeating. All these effects are shown in cell cultures or possibly animals, but no definite studies in humans. On the other hand, there have been studies showing that whole grain consumption is associated with a lower BMI. There have been human studies that show that consumption of whole grain is related to improved blood glucose control. Regular consumption of whole grain products is associated with a significant reduction in the risk of type 2 diabetes, heart disease, and weight gain. The human body is amazingly complex. When I see no definite support for a dietary recommendation, I conclude we may just not understand what is going on. There are some people who seem to have an intolerance to wheat, but don't have celiac disease or wheat allergy. It may be that these people may be better able to tolerate wheat flour in which the bran and germ have been removed and the flour bleached, all of which will lower the wheat germ agglutinin. These people may be able to tolerate white bread without difficulty, and, if so, should avoid whole wheat bread. I do not know if this is a wheat germ agglutinin issue or something else. It doesn't matter to the food engineer. She just adjusts the maintenance diet appropriately. We have been eating whole wheat bread from the beginning. I know something has changed over the last 100 years, leading us to obesity. Food processing has changed, as has wheat genetics. Right now, I am sticking with my whole wheat bread, stone ground, or at least large particle size, organic, and sourdough starter. It has been this way a long time, and I will need better evidence to change my recommendation. I agree there are a few who should not eat gluten, and probably a few who should not eat whole wheat bread, but for most of us, I believe this is the right way to go. Again, as I proceed through my writing of books on diet and health, I cannot help but get the impression that the gut microbiome and corresponding intestinal barrier may be the basis for many of these nutritional and immunological dysfunctions. The modern diet and environment are affecting us in many ways. I am trying to get you to change the things over which you have control to achieve better health, not to make you live forever. You know I am a doctor of mycology and not a licensed physician. Hence, do not take any of this content as medical advice. I hope you use your common sense. If you are sick, do not just read the book. Go see some kind of healthcare provider. In the meantime, I highly encourage you to buy my book, Diet and Health, especially for the health part.